Hello, and welcome to the Jubilee Church Podcast. Jubilee Church exists to help all people know God, find family, discover purpose, and make a difference. If you would like to learn more or connect with us, please visit our website at jubileestl.org.
He is risen indeed. Good morning. Welcome. My name is Greg. I am one of the elders here in our city location. Our lead pastor, Brian, is in Sunset Hills, ministering with them because of increased numbers on Easter Sunday. He's preaching three sermons there. He didn't want to do five. I don't know. Seems kind of lazy to me, but he asked me to preach here in his stead. And what a privilege and an honor it is to minister to you this morning. In his 2015 book, Just Mercy, lawyer and activist Brian Stevenson profiles the wrongful conviction and eventual exoneration of Walter McMillan. Walter McMillan is a tragic figure, a poor black man from Alabama. He's framed for murder and sentenced to death row. Now, as Stevenson masterfully engulfs us, his reader, in the hopes and the fears of this marginalized prisoner, I was overwhelmed with anger, absolute fury. I was incensed to read the story, to learn that for the sake of expediency, convenience, ambition, and racism, this man, Walter McMillan's, his life was thrown away, discarded like a candy wrapper, used up and tossed aside. Now, the moment of McMillan's release from prison, wow, that was equally exhilarating. A moment suggesting that if somehow the truth about McMillan's innocence could come to light, maybe there is a possibility that there is justice in the world. Maybe, just maybe, all the wrongs could be made right. This flicker of hope arising from McMillan's long struggle for justice was, this is only a hint of what Easter offers us this morning. You see, in the Good Friday narrative that we just heard and read, we see the culmination of human sin on display. A confluence of failure, the failure of religion, the failure of justice, the failure of friendship. And at the center, in this inflection point, stands one man, Jesus of Nazareth. Wrongfully convicted, targeted by the religious establishment, tortured and humiliated, abandoned by his closest friends. Jesus stands as the very definition of adding insult to injury. And as he hangs on that cross, suffocating under the weight of his own body, with his last breath, he begs God for mercy for those who would kill him. This only adds to and heightens the sense of the magnitude of this injustice. As this righteous man is slaughtered against a backdrop of envy, and political expediency and cowardice. Is your anger stoked? It should be. But I have good news for you today. Because the joy of Easter is built on the ruins of Good Friday. That is, all that Easter is, everything it speaks to us about perseverance and triumph and new beginnings, is sharpened and intensified by the unfathomable travesty of Jesus' death. But before we can truly appreciate Easter, we must face the realities of Good Friday. And it all arose from this question. Jesus is apprehended by the authorities. He comes before the Jewish council, the high priest, and he's asked a question. I adjure you by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. Easter is Jesus' answer. Whether or not Jesus is who the Gospels claim him to be, the unique and divine Son of God, hinges on this remarkable moment in history. Because let's face it, if God truly raised Jesus from the dead, then it validates everything he claims and everything he did. In this single act, Jesus' resurrection, God puts his endorsement on Jesus. On Jesus' words, on Jesus' miracles, on Jesus' ministry, everything that Jesus claimed to be able to do. Now, as Lee Strobel, an award-winning author and professor of Christian thought, has said, the resurrection is the supreme vindication of Jesus' divine identity and his inspired teaching. It's the proof of his triumph over sin and death. It's the foreshadowing of the resurrection of his followers. It's the basis of Christian hope. It's the miracle of all miracles. And if I have one goal this morning, it would be that every person in this room would leave in agreement with that statement. So I'm going to read it again. The resurrection is the supreme vindication of Jesus' divine identity and his inspired teaching. It's a proof of his triumph over sin and death. It's the foreshadowing of the resurrection of his followers. It's the basis of Christian hope. It's the miracle of all miracles. Amen. But first, let's recap how we came to this point. We've been in the book of Matthew. This is Matthew's account of Jesus' life. Matthew was one of the members of his inner circle. And after this meteoric rise as an itinerant preacher roaming around the Judean countryside, Jesus, this rabbi with no formal training, a carpenter by trade, he enters the city of Jerusalem. Less than a week before his death, he's riding in not only on a donkey, but on an unprecedented wave of popularity. And then, when he should have been enjoying the heights of his success, it all seemingly crashes down around him. How did this come to be? Well, first, religion fails. You see, in this final week of Jesus' life, the Pharisees, trusted teachers, educated interpreters of Jewish law, they come to embody the failures of religion. Religion is man's attempt to reach up to God. And although the Pharisees had received a tradition of God's teaching and God's law, they felt it wasn't sufficient. They began to build on it and add to it to try to beef it up or make it more effective. In their mind, people needed a little more help. And they saw that Jesus came as a threat to them, to their system, to their hierarchy, to their influence. Whereas the Pharisees were promoting human efforts to reach God, Jesus came as one sent by God. Jesus was God's plan to reach man. And so there is a conflict. The two cannot exist together. The Pharisees recognize this threat and they see Jesus as challenging their authority. They want to defend their precious time-honored traditions. But the problem is, they don't recognize that all those traditions delivered by God are actually preparing people's hearts for Jesus. The sacrificial system, the temple, the law, all of these things were meant to point to something greater. And Jesus came to say, I am that. In fact, he said to the Pharisees, he said, you search the scriptures, but you don't have life because you don't see that they're pointing to me. I am the fulfillment of everything you hold dear. No, the Pharisees saw him as a threat and they wanted him removed. Now, the Pharisees are cast in contradistinction to John the Baptist. John the Baptist, you might know, also is a mysterious figure, comes out of the wilderness. He has a preaching ministry. He's suddenly wildly popular. This is what John says about his own ministry when he's confronted with Jesus. He says, he, that is Jesus, must increase, but I must decrease. John is willing to step back, embracing his role as a forerunner to prepare the way, whereas the Pharisees are not willing to give up that place and position. So they hatch a plot to destroy Jesus in order to preserve themselves. Religion fails. But not just religion, justice fails. You see, when the Pharisees handed Jesus over to Pilate, the Roman governor in Judea, Pilate quickly sees through the plot. He sees that it's out of envy that the Jewish leaders have brought these trumped up charges on Jesus. And Pilate had the power to just simply release Jesus, right? To throw out this lawsuit. However, Pilate's own moral relativism, what is truth anyway? His utilitarian philosophy leads him to condemn Jesus. What does the scripture tell us? It says, when Pilate saw that he was gaining nothing, arguing and pleading with the crowd, but rather that a riot was beginning, he took water and washed his hands of the situation. That is, Pilate, rather than serving justice and upholding Roman law, he says, well, I gotta control this crowd. I gotta put down this riot. The easiest way to do it is to just do away with Jesus. Give them what they want. Appease the crowd. And Jesus' life is discarded, like the candy wrapper. Pilate's goal is political expediency. I mean, what will Caesar think if I lose control of this crowd in the middle of this festival? This is the biggest moment in the Jewish year. It's Passover. The city of Jerusalem is filled with people. If a riot breaks out, how will I control it? I don't know what to do. I know. I'll do the easy thing. Guilty or innocent, what does it really matter? What is truth? So Pilate quiets and quells the riot. Rather than exercise his God-given authority and his Roman-given authority, Pilate abdicates his authority, washing his hands. Cowardly, actually. The Roman legal institution fails because Pilate fails. But that's not it. Friendship fails. You know, the Greek philosopher Aristotle said that friendship is the highest virtue. In Greek society and Roman society at the time, the loyalty of friendship would have been seen as the greatest virtue, the pinnacle of human relationships. Not like romantic love is in our society. No, a friend, someone who chooses to stand by your side in thick and thin. And this thought would have been prevalent in Jesus' day. Which makes the account, the gospel accounts of the disciples all the more disappointing. Jesus is betrayed by Judas, one of the 12 in his inner circle. A man who walked with him, observed his miracles, heard his teaching, saw his character for 3 years. And then in his time of need, he's literally abandoned by his disciples. Peter denies him 3 times. None of the others are anywhere to be found, except maybe John and Mary, his mother, are present when he breathes his last. In fact, in Matthew 26, Jesus predicts his own betrayal and abandonment. And what are the disciples saying? Peter says to him, even if I must die with you, I will not deny you. Oh, Peter. And all the disciples said the same. Now, despite this undoubtedly heartfelt declaration, Peter does just that. He denies him. Truly, Isaiah the prophet, who wrote these words 700 years before Jesus' death, he was right in describing Jesus this way. He wrote, he was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised and we esteemed him not. Could you stand at the cross and watch the bruised and bleeding Jesus, flesh torn, hanging from him, coughing and gasping? I couldn't. I would have turned my face. And so we see that the religious people, the authoritarian people, and even the beloved people in Jesus' life all fail him. Now, I suspect you've seen the same in your own life. Has religion failed you? Some of us have lived our lives around strict, moralistic people. modern Pharisees, if you will. And what has that harshness taught us? I don't know if you, like me, grew up in an era of whoopings. Some of you know what a switch is. Some of you were sent to get your own switch. Yeah, that's not like on the wall for the light, guys. That's like, you know, a branch from a tree. So you get your spanking done. I'll admit, more than I would like to admit, I had my fair share of whoopings and spankings. But the harshness, what did it teach me? Did it teach me virtue? Did it teach me to pursue goodness? No, it taught me to stop getting caught. It taught me that outward behavioral change was the goal. Some of us have learned that. That's the lesson of the Pharisees, the lesson that the Pharisees would have taught. More rules, more regulations, do these things, don't do those things, clean yourself up, look good. But it doesn't change the heart. So we learn the lesson from the Pharisees, not the lesson about the Pharisees. Because Jesus came and said this about the Pharisees. He said, they heap up burdens on men's backs, and they do not lift a finger to help them. Is that what religion has taught you? Maybe your experience of religion is much worse. Abuse and neglect and moral failures. They're all around us. I mean, you could fill volumes with the failures of priests and pastors and Christian celebrities. Maybe you see the emptiness of religion. You see, religion tries to dress us up and make us look good to God and to others. But if you're like me, you recognize that religion is like the emperor's new clothes. And the only person who's convinced that they look good in the emperor's new clothes was the emperor. The rest of us can see through the ruse. We see the brokenness. We see the hypocrisy. We see the failures. We don't want to follow in that foolishness. But here is the difference between Jesus and religion. While religion tries to make us presentable to God, Jesus offers for those who know that they're not presentable, that he will carry them to God. How can we be sure, though, that Jesus' offer to bring us to the Father is legitimate, that he can actually do it? The resurrection, the empty tomb. This is God's once and for all final statement that Jesus Christ is who he said he is. Because God wouldn't raise a liar. He wouldn't resurrect a man who was leading us all astray, spreading lies about himself and about God. But if Jesus is who he claimed to be, then the resurrection becomes God's exclamation point on all that Jesus did and all that Jesus said. I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. I am the living bread that came down from heaven. Anyone who eats of this bread will live forever. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. So what reason do you have today to believe that Jesus is unique, standing in stark contrast to all the other religions and philosophies and fanatics? He's the only one who died and the only one who rose. Now, he's not the only person who was resurrected. The Bible claims that many rose to new life, but he's the only one who predicted it. And the only one who offers to die as a ransom for many. Now, maybe the failures of religion are like, yeah, I mean, Greg, I see what you're talking about. But, you know, it's all this injustice. That's what really riles me up. That's what keeps me up at night. You see, in Jesus' own life, we see the devastating consequences of a corrupt justice system. Pilate was delegated authority to uphold Roman law. You had one job, Pilate. You had one job. Maybe you or a loved one have been unlawfully arrested, wrongfully accused, or unjustly convicted. Sadly, there are too many stories like Walter McMillan in our country. And that despite the fact that we actually try to have justice. There are many countries in the world where the government is completely collapsed and there is no justice, no police, no courts, no chance. In this life, sadly, perfect justice will always be a fleeting dream. No person has perfect knowledge, perfect insight, or perfect wisdom. Unless, of course, you consider the one who is three persons in one, that is God. You see, God's solution, God's answer to the injustice of the world is that every person will stand before him, the holy and righteous God. And every person will give an account of the life that they've lived. So every victim can be assured that every victimizer will answer to the righteous and holy God. That's right. Every person in this room will stand before their maker, the creator, the one who has perfect knowledge and perfect understanding, the only one who can deliver right judgment. Now, anyone who longs to see the weak protected or to see justice delivered should love the doctrine of God's judgment until they realize that they themselves are a perpetrator. See, about 2 weeks ago, I got a phone call from my bank. They said, hey, we noticed some unauthorized transfers. Can you confirm or deny these? And as they tried to lead me through a process of looking into it, I realized that they were trying to convince me to wire money to somebody. And I suddenly loved the doctrine of God's judgment. And I was thinking, man, I hope this guy gets what he deserves, trying to scam me out of my hard-earned money. And then I got home, and I was again surrounded by the people who know all of my failures and my flaws, my family. My wife is in the front row here. She's nodding her head. And I realized that I'm not innocent. All the times that I've lost my temper, that I've failed to come through with a promise, times when I've failed in my responsibilities as a husband or a father, too consumed with my own ambition or other things. And I realize that every time I beg God for his judgment to come, I realize that I too am staring down judgment. And so even the victim has to account for their own life. My enthusiasm for Judgment Day begins to wane. Because no one is righteous. No one on the count of their good record can commend themselves to God. No one can stand up to the standard. Religion and morality may have squeezed some good works out of us, but they haven't removed our bad. So how do we survive our cosmic day of reckoning with this God? I'm so thankful for Easter, for the resurrection, that God and the Father and God the Son conspired together to find a solution for human injustice. They turned this heinous act of injustice into a beautiful moment of grace. How? Because Jesus, who went to the cross without a record of sin, without his own rap sheet to pay for, offered his life for those who would trust him. See, he took my rap sheet on the cross and to the grave, and when he was raised, he left it behind, which means that there's newness of life. There's an opportunity for forgiveness for all who would receive it. Once again, God's stamp of approval on Jesus. What did John say about Jesus when he came? He said, look, the Lamb who takes away the sin of the world. This is how Jesus does it, in substitution. John Stott describes it this way. He says, sin is men trying to take the place of God, but salvation is God taking the place of man. Jesus suffering in our place. Now, finally, friendship fails. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross. He saved others. Let him save himself. He's the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross, and we will believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God deliver him. These are the taunts that Jesus received as he hung on that cross. The irony of these statements is that, spoken by his detractors, they challenge Jesus not to demonstrate his power, but actually to desert his post. You see, because Jesus willingly went to the cross to accomplish something that no one else could accomplish. Only the perfect, righteous Son of God could die in the place of others. Because every other person who dies, dies for their own sin. So if Jesus comes down off the cross in a show of glory, ha-ha, gotcha, who will die for you? Who will suffer in your place? God does not ignore injustice. But this innocent volunteer, this righteous man, he offered to be the punishment so that you could avoid it. To prove his identity by coming off the cross, he would have had to forfeit his mission to save. Peter, who denies Jesus, later pins these words. He writes this. He says, "For Christ also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might," what? "Bring us to God." Only the perfect Son of God could achieve this salvation. So in the face of betrayal and abandonment from his closest friends, Jesus Christ becomes the friend of sinners. The greatest friend. Because what does he say? He says this, "Greater love has no one than this, that someone would lay down his life for his friends." Maybe you're here today. Maybe you've never quite understood what Jesus' death was really about. Many have described him as a good example, a wise teacher, and that he is. Jesus is the ultimate example of a life well lived, of compassion embodied, of love in action. But let me tell you this, an example I don't need. I don't need another example of a great man doing great things that I could never do. Some of you will catch this reference, many of you probably won't. In 1998, and there was an ad campaign from Gatorade featuring a prominent basketball player. And it went like, "Sometimes I dream that he is me. Got to dream, that's how I dream to be. Sometimes I move, sometimes I groove like Mike. Try to be like Mike. I wanna be like Mike." Everybody wanted to be like Michael Jordan. His airness. I gotta tell you, I watched hours of footage of Michael Jordan. Did I ever jump from the free throw line to dunk? No. Did I ever hit the game-winning shot? No. I could barely warm the bench. I don't need the example of Michael Jordan to help me. It did not help me. I do not need the example of Jesus dying on a cross to help me. Because if I go to the cross, I will just die. I won't rise. I won't save. I cannot do that. But I'll tell you what, if I had Michael Jordan on my team, substituted in for me at the last second to hit the game-winning shot, he wins and I win. We all win. I need to be connected to Jesus in a way that his reward becomes my reward. His power comes into my life. I don't need an example. I need a champion. Jesus Christ is God's champion. And he offers to do it for you. Amen. And you, and you, and you, and you in the back. That, my friends, is Easter. Jesus, the God-man, giving it all, carrying us on his back to victory, winning not an earthly trophy, but heavenly reward. Forgiveness of sin, acceptance by God, adoption into his family, power for living, everything you ever wanted or needed, he can give it to you. In his resurrection, he achieved it all. He showed us that he has the power to do it, and he gives us the promise that he will. You can enter into his new beginning because of the empty grave. That is what the risen Christ offers you today. And it all hinges on this resurrection. But can we really trust it? Can we really believe that this happened? I mean, come on. It's 2024. What evidence is there that Jesus Christ really did this? Before I close, I want to put that question to rest. Lee Strobel, who I quoted earlier, he's a smart guy. He graduated from Yale Law School. He's a former investigative journalist. He's a converted atheist. He interviewed 13 scholars in fields of history and philosophy and medicine and law, and he published a New York Times bestseller with his conclusions about, is the resurrection reliable? And this is what he says. He says, in this quest for truth, I've used my experience as a legal affairs journalist to look at numerous categories of proof: eyewitness evidence, documentary evidence, corroborating evidence, rebuttal evidence, scientific evidence, psychological evidence, circumstantial evidence, and yes, even fingerprint evidence. These are the same classifications you would encounter in a courtroom. I was thoroughly stunned by the quantity and the quality of the evidence for Christ. And I agree with him. Any serious examination into the historical accounts concludes that these disciples really did find an empty tomb, that they were convinced that they had seen with their eyes and spoken with their mouths and heard with their ears and even touched with their hands a bodily resurrected Jesus. No other ancient historical event has as much evidence or as many attestations as the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And if you leave here this morning with one single thought in your mind, I want you to know that you can trust the biblical account of the resurrection. It is more reliable than the Declaration of Independence, the United States Constitution, or the Emancipation Proclamation, documents that we as Americans implicitly trust because there are more copies of the Gospels reliably from their authors than there are of any ancient manuscript. Now, if that's not enough, right? If my arguments from the text aren't enough, if Lee Strobel's arguments from his investigations aren't enough, I commend to you this. We have four people who want to tell you about their eyewitness testimony of meeting and experiencing the resurrected Jesus.